Poetry on the Radio. Poetry in and around the ACT. Today, the last of three installments featuring Canberra-based poet Keith Harrison's thoughts on poetry. Plus, the Rhyming Bugle. Poetry news from around the ACT region. For Outsound FM Community Radio, I'm Peter Searles. On last week's installment of Poetry on the Radio, Canberra-based poet Keith Harrison, a particularly astute poetry thinker, shared some thoughts on the great modern poet Robert Frost. The week before, he spoke about how reading poetry out loud, with the ear rather than the eye, can greatly enhance appreciation of it, and of poetic craft. Today, he discusses the nature and challenges of poetry about war.
Hello, and a very good day to everyone. Today I'm calling these reflections Voices of War. The Irish poet W.B. Yeats once proclaimed that passive suffering is not a theme for poetry, and because war is a form of passive suffering, it's best for poets to leave it alone. This seems to me another example of the kind of statement that we are asked to believe simply because it's made by a famous poet. Surely we can counter what Yeats says in at least two ways. First, some poets have written first-rate poems about war. And second, since a good deal of human history has been taken up with, and multitudes of peace-loving citizens have been destroyed by warfare of various kinds, it's incumbent on writers to say something about it so that we can at least begin to deal with it fully and imaginatively. It seems to be a central and enduring element of how the human race behaves, and we achieve nothing by ignoring it. I'm not saying that warfare should be an essential element of what all writers consider, only that Yeats's blanket statement needs careful examination. What Yeats was perhaps pointing to, at least obliquely, is that in the world's literature, taken as a whole, there's not much great writing to be found in poetry or in prose about war, as we might expect there to be, or in a deep sense, need there to be. It seems to be very difficult to write about it. Yet there is, as I said, some great writing about war, and today my self-appointed task is to question Yeats's proclamation and show that war can be, and most certainly has been, a subject for great poems. As a way of approaching this, I want to say that if I was asked to name a talismanic modern figure to begin a discussion of war poetry, I would have to use the name of Wilfred Owen, who was killed in the trenches in his mid-20s, just before the armistice in the First World War. I'd base my judgment on several poems, including Exposure, Strange Meeting, where two ghosts, one British and one German, meet each other, having killed each other. And finally, the poem Dulce et Decorum Est. Now, each of these poems gives us a different slant on war, but they all have one thing in common, which I'll come to. The one I want to concentrate on today is Dulce et Decorum Est, a title Owen takes from the Roman poet Horace. Horace's dictum, which in full means it is sweet and fitting to die for one's fatherland, is given in Owen's poem a totally different meaning from the one Horace originally intended. Like many great poems, Owen's poem is simple, and it doesn't need detailed explanation, although its implications are profound, and they've been once again horribly evoked by some of the present conflicts we, as a species, are facing at this very moment. Here's Owen's poem. Dulce et decorum est. Bent double, like old beggars under sacks, knock-kneed, coughing like hags, we cursed through sludge, till on the haunting flares we turned our backs, and toward our distant rest began to trudge. Men marched asleep. Many had lost their boots, but limped on, blood-shod, all went lame, all blind. Drunk with fatigue, deaf even to the hoots of gas shells dropping softly behind. Gas! Gas! Quick, boys! An ecstasy of fumbling, fitting the clumsy helmets just in time. And someone still was yelling out and stumbling and floundering, a man in fire or lime. Dim through the misty panes and thick green light, as under a green sea, I saw him drowning. In all my dreams, before my helpless sight, he plunges at me, guttering, choking, drowning. If in some smothering dreams you too could pace behind the wagon that we flung him in and watch the white eyes writhing in his face, his hanging face like a devil's, sick of sin, if you could hear at every jolt the blood come gargling from the froth-corrupted lungs, obscene as cancer, bitter as the cut of vile, incurable sores on innocent tongues, my friend, you would not tell with such high zest to children ardent for some desperate glory the old lie, dulce et decorum est, pro patria mori. I want to claim that this is one of the unquestionably great poems in our language, and I do so for several reasons. The first is the same one that applies to some of the most disturbing works we can think of. No one that I know of would take exception to the opinion that King Lear gives us a vision of human life which is all but unthinkable. At the same time, and this is the real mystery and puzzle, although it fills us with horror, it's redeemed by the power and eloquence of the imagination which created it. Written by a writer of lesser mind and lesser verbal skill, it would destroy itself and leave us in total despair. But it doesn't. Because of its clarity and intelligence and its verbal power, by the most striking of paradoxes, it sustains us, and so does Owen's poem. Lately, in telecasts, we've seen too many times, in my view, the celebrated speech of John Kennedy, which ends in a rhetorical flourish. Do not ask what your country can do for you, but what you could do for your country, which is surely one of the most simplistic pieces of xenophobia ever uttered by a world leader, though I admit Kennedy does have some pretty stiff competition. If ever a commandment from on high needed to be examined and rigorously questioned, it is this one. One merely has to cast one's mind back to the Vietnam years, when the US had, at the very least, three major war criminals: Richard Nixon, Henry Kissinger, and Robert McNamara in charge. Not only of the fate of the nation, but of the very lives of thousands of young people in America and Australia and elsewhere. As I said to my own students in America at the time, not to question the lies and motives of those leaders, along with so many other so-called patriots, is to put oneself in the hands of people who do not give a brass penny what measures are taken to ensure the fulfilment of their own highly questionable ambitions. So that's the second reason why I regard Owen's poem so highly. It dares to go with immense courage against the full force of conventional patriotism. Like much of the eloquent rhetoric in Yeats's poetry and prose, it captures the imagination, but it has another quality. Unlike Yeats, what Owen says in his poem, history has proven to be true. We may, in Australia, have some good reason to proclaim the Second World War as a just war. But for so many of the others we have let ourselves be involved in, the Boer War, the First World War, Vietnam, the Gulf War, and Iraq, we cannot find a convincing justification to pass on to our children and our grandchildren unless we have been so blinded by an unquestioning propaganda that we have lost our way. My uncle was shot in Gallipoli as he climbed the cliffs into a rain of overwhelming Turkish machine gun fire. If he stood here right now, I could not give him a reason for his death, simply because there isn't one. The mindless eagerness for the kind of sacrifice some of our politicians have espoused is exactly the target that Owen aims at in his poem, and he hits that target dead centre. In the teeth of Yeats, that kind of witness, especially from one who is about to die, is salutary and life-giving. We have to have the guts as parents and teachers and brothers and sisters to foster it. The criticism that such a view is merely political evinces a stupidity that, in my view, is almost unfathomable. War's real subject, as Owen writes in a letter, is pity. Our national obsession in Australia with our past wars takes no account of what Owen is really saying, and that's why we need him, and we'll go on needing him. I want to change perspective here to get at the theme of war in another way. In the last few talks, I've pointed to the part sound plays in revealing the deeper meaning of a poem, and I want to explore that a bit further by sharing with you a poem that you might find very odd because it's not written in words, but in only one word, or more accurately, particles of one word. The writer is Ernst Jandl, a contemporary Austrian poet who died 20 years ago. Jandl was a follower of the well-known Dadaist Kurt Schwitters, and the poem is called Schützengraben, which is literally shooting grave, though we normally translate the word by trench, as in trench warfare. Here's Jandl's poem. Schützengraben. Schützengraben, Schützengraben. Grum. Sun grum, sun grum, sun grum, grum. Schützen, schützen. Schützen grum, schützen grum. Grit, grit. Grrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrr Shit! St. Grimm! St. Grimm! Shit! 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 Some people on hearing this poem have exclaimed, but that's not a poem. And I think it's better maybe to ask a different question. Does the poem work or not? And after having heard Yandel read it in person, my own answer is an unequivocal yes, it does. But I think we have to change our expectation of what a poem should do, the same way as when we first hear "'Twas Brillig and the Slithy Toves." We pay attention, in both cases, to the sounds. What we hear in Schützengraben is the landscape that's captured in Erich Remarque's novel All Quiet on the Western Front, or better, the landscape just before the quiet and immediately after. And what we hear in both the sounds and the silence of the poem is the utter futility and mindlessness of war. But I would make this caveat. We can't get that meaning and that landscape and that soundscape just by reading the poem with the eye. It has to be performed with the same attentiveness with which we might play a short but expressive piece of music. It's only then that we take note of the final sounds. T, t, t. Then silence. And we perhaps imagine the moon revealing the complete deadness and meaninglessness that hangs over an empty battlefield. This is a very unusual poem. I know nothing else like it. I would claim it does something to our thinking. Whether or not it's a poem is not nearly so interesting as the fact that if we let it, it jolts us awake. It makes us really think about war. So these are two very different voices that come from warfare. Let's change tack again. I want to invite you to take part in an imaginative exercise. Suppose you've been teaching some young people, many of whom will soon be conscripted to fight in a war. Suppose that one of them, in his early 20s, came to your office yesterday and told you in confidence about a disturbing quarrel he'd had last weekend when he went home to his family farm on midterm break. This young man's three brothers are already fighting in Vietnam, and when he explained to his parents that he didn't want to join them because he could not see any reason why his country had become involved in what was basically a civil war which had nothing to do with him or his country, his family reaction was to say that anyone who was not willing to die for his country was not really a member of their family. In that young man's class, we've all been studying for some weeks Shakespeare's history plays, particularly Henry IV Part I, in which Hotspur has to fight the young pretender, Prince Hal, because he, Hotspur, is protecting the anointed king from the usurper Bolingbroke. And when they fight, Hal eventually kills Hotspur. Imagine also that you and your students have recently watched a film about the life of T.S. Eliot, whose The Wasteland was written in the aftermath of World War I, a film in which the war wounded are seen in that jerky cinematography that we find in old films. And all these marching veterans have the same leg missing, and you watch them hopping rhythmically across the screen and you stare in amazement. There seems to be thousands of them. You've been carrying around two more things in your mind. Shakespeare's King Henry doesn't fight in the battle. Instead, he has a dozen or so soldiers dress in a replica of his battle dress, so that the enemy, when they kill these counterfeit kings, will believe that they have killed the king himself and have therefore won the battle. Finally, you can't help thinking that there's an uncomfortable parallel between the way that some of our huge industrial corporations recruit their armies of faceless workers and pin them behind desks or machines for years until they die well before their bodies do, and the way that in a time of war, armies treat their foot soldiers as expendable items. You can't get it out of your head that there's a very disturbing relationship between rampant capitalism and warfare. With all this swirling in your head, you sit down in the college cafe to a sandwich and a latte and grab your biro, and because it's the only thing available, you take your paperback copy of Henry IV and, writing very fast on the inside back cover, you come up with this. How many one-legged soldiers have marched for two-legged kings? Look at them, hopping across the screen. Black suits, pressed for Remembrance Day. medals from Vimy Ridge and Passchendaele banging against their chests, and the film jumping to the rhythm of their crutches. There are enough to fill five cities, and even on single legs they keep faithful step, eyes fixed as bayonets, dead ahead. How soon they forget that the king has dressed himself in a score of counterfeit uniforms, all bloodied now and stiff under a song of flies. Meanwhile, the king himself, in a long frock and feathered hat, surveys the campaign from a distant manor, advisers swirling around him with maps as he smooths the expensive silk along his thighs. At this and any time, not to be paranoid is highest foolishness. This executive, whose eyes you cannot see behind his brilliant lenses, will never hack your hands off. He will take what dreams in you on the 20th floor at coffee break, the part that shapes a tune for your flute, or bends a clay bowl to the exact form of your delight, and he will tweezer it out of you very slowly. See them milling there in the quadrangle, these youngsters ready to be crippled for someone else's dream of excellence, which carries them to a high apartment above the wrinkled river, an apartment blank as Hotspur's eye as he stares up at the cold clouds riding over. And everywhere the young pretender struts, he builds his kingdom on the skull bones of his father. And once at twilight, alone in the royal anteroom, he slips the crown over his curls, listens to his father's sick breathing, and smiles into the mirror. His name is Hal, and he is everywhere. Watch him, I tell you. Go well down river. Build a small shack on the tidal flats, camouflaged like an egret's nest, so the black patrol boats can't pick you out with their long eye beams at midnight. Hunker down. Be suspicious of any communique which offers terms for your surrender. Later on, you realise that you have written this poem out of a sharp concern for your students, like the one who came to your office in such mental pain. You call your poem Legs. And you also realise much later again that one of the reasons you may need to write a war poem is to try to stop your students from being killed for no purpose whatsoever. And you recall what Yeats said about war and conclude that there is no reason on earth why, on this matter at least, you should take any notice of him at all. Good reading, good thinking, and good exploring.
Today, on the last of three special episodes of Poetry on the Radio, Keith Harrison has shared his thoughts on what makes for compelling war poetry. You can listen back to three programs featuring Keith's thoughts on poetry by going to the ArtSound website, artsound.fm, pull down under the Programs tab to Poetry on the Radio. You can read all about Keith Harrison's rich life in letters in his experimental memoir, Not Quite Ithaca. He has published numerous books, including several volumes of poetry, among them Changes, New and Collected Poems, 1962 to 2002. He has also translated Virgil, Catullus, Rilke, Lorca, Pushkin, Baudelaire, Francis Jammes, and others. From 1968 to his retirement in 1996, he was Professor of English and Writer-in-Residence at Carleton College in Minnesota. Good news for ArtSound listeners is that he and Peter Monahan, producer of Poetry on the Radio, have neared completion of a radio drama version of Keith's verse translation of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, the 14th century narrative poem, and that will air soon on ArtSound in coming weeks. For Poetry on the Radio on ArtSound FM Community Radio, I'm Peter Searles.
The Rhyming Bugle. Coming soon to Smith's Alternative in Civic, on December 2, Jeff's poetry features Ross Gillette and Carmel Summers. Ross Gillette's poems have been widely published and featured three times in Black Ink's The Best Australian Poems. His books include The Sea Factory from Five Islands Press New Poet Series 2006 and the chapbook Wonder Wax and Other Poems with Mark Time Books 2010. The Daylesford, Victoria-based poet's work has received many awards, including the 2023 Williamstown Literature Festival's Ada Cambridge Poetry Prize for his poem Coastal Collapse. Reviewing Ross Gillette's Swimmer in the Dust in the Canberra Times, Jeff Page wrote, "A constant element in Ross Gillette's work is his musicality, a more subtle and contemporary variety, influenced perhaps by Wallace Stevens." On December 9, That Poetry Thing presents Kavita Nandan and Lauren Wooding. Lauren Wooding, who was born and raised in Canberra, is an organiser and regular reader at That Poetry Thing and is a web developer administrator of the Kindred Trees Poetry Project. Lauren draws on her experiences as a trans woman, software engineer and traveller to write poetry ranging from light-hearted funny poems to deeply political works fueled by youthful anger. Kavita Ivy Nandan was born in New Delhi, grew up in Suva, and migrated to Australia in 1987 after the Fiji military coups. She lived in Canberra for more than 25 years and received three Arts ACT grants before moving to Sydney in 2017. She is the author of a book of poems, Return to What Remains, and a novel, Home After Dark, and she edited a book of memoirs, Stolen Worlds, Fiji Indian Fragments, and co-edited a collection of essays, Unfinished Journeys, India File from Canberra, and an anthology of poetry and short fiction, Riding the Pacific. On December 16, That Poetry Thing is an end-of-year open mic. Some of the poets mentioned in this issue of The Rhyming Bugle have been featured on episodes of Poetry on the Radio. Listen back at artsound.fm, pull down under the Programs tab to Poetry on the Radio. ArtSound FM is a listener-supported community radio station. You can support the station's many arts-related broadcasts by donating or becoming a member through our website, artsound.fm, or by calling 6295 7444. Poetry on the Radio is heard Sundays at 4:30 p.m. and Mondays at 10:30 p.m. on ArtSound FM. The program is produced weekly on unceded First Nations country, in the studios of ArtSound FM in Canberra. Series hosts are Kimberly K. Williams and Peter Searles. Producer is Peter Monahan. Our theme is from an ancient hymn to the muse Calliope by Gregorio Paniagua and the Atrium Musica de Madrid.